Hi, my name is David Lankus. I'm sorry I can't be there in person or live via Skype, but by the time you're hearing or seeing this, I'm sitting in a hospital bed getting a little chemotherapy, which is not as fun as it sounds. Actually, it doesn't even sound fun. Anyway, I'd much rather be there, actually. But I hope you will pardon my absence, and I want to talk a little bit about the idea of libraries facilitator. This concept that a library, and as we'll talk about in a moment, a librarian, is a facilitator, and how they facilitate and what they facilitate, I don't think is a new idea to us. I think the concept that we've always seen our profession, we've always seen our institutions as people that aid, the people that serve. But we really need to begin to dig down a little bit further into this notion. So that's what I'd like to do. And where I come from, I want to come from sort of the sales pitch that I've been giving, which is the notion of what do we mean by facilitator? And where I come up with this phrase, where I come up with this concept, is really around a mission statement. A mission statement I propose for the profession, and that is that the mission of librarians is to improve society, feel free to stop it there, through facilitating knowledge creation within their communities. So that's a mission that I think we could look at as a profession. Once again, not an institutional mission. That's not the mission of the Library of Congress or my local public library or such, but me as an individual. We'll come back to that in a moment. The interesting thing is when I first sort of started bandying this mission around, actually the first time I sort of put it out in public, I was at a large conference around collection development. And so that there were librarians there and the collection development technical services staff, but there were also vendors and publishers and such. And the very first question I got when I put this up was, I'm a publisher. That's my mission. Why is that the mission of librarians and not the mission of a publisher? And what's very interesting is as you begin thinking about, as you begin considering this notion and what it means throughout the day of libraries facilitator, realize that the notion of facilitation is broader than just what we do. Right? We talk about schools as facilitators of creation of knowledge. This publisher very much felt that that was their job, that what they did is they connected authors to readers, they connected experts to people learning, etc. That curation, that editorial process, that publishing process was one of facilitation. But we also have, frankly, commercial entities. Facebook would argue that what they are doing is facilitating social conversation. They're facilitating networks of people connecting and serving and sharing information. And just as these institutions see themselves in the facilitation business, we have individuals in that facilitation business as well. Increasingly, doctors are starting to see themselves as facilitators, which is a rather awkward and uncomfortable position for them to be in because for so long they were the source, they were the authority. You came in, you were sick, they looked at you, said, "You're sick, here's what you take, go away." That was about all there was to it. Or, "You're sick, I can't do anything, go away." Whatever it is. But now what doctors are really doing is creating a sort of participatory network or creating and facilitating the idea with nurses, with doctors and nurse practitioners and clinicians and all these folks, the allied health, about coming together and seeing how do you stay well? How do you continually improve your own health? What is it that the doctor can prescribe, but what is it that you can do through exercise, through monitoring, etc.? And in fact, it's not just the test that the doctors give you that you use to find out how well you are. You can take your own blood pressure. You can look at your own sort of circulatory system and how well you're doing. You can track on a daily basis. This thing is called a Fitbit Force. And it not only tells me the time, but how many steps I've taken and how long I've walked and how many stairs and all this other stuff. And so I'm constantly sort of monitoring my health. That's the idea of a doctor now facilitating health. They're helping me stay healthy. They're not curing me. And a teacher in higher education, a teacher in primary and secondary schools have always seen themselves as sort of the guide on the side, not the sage on the stage, where the learning we're starting to understand through lots of studies and understanding, we don't teach people. People learn. I can't teach you, make you understand something. I can simply present all the information, the context, the motivation, the rewards, the context by which you are going to learn it, by which you're going to absorb it. So increasingly, these professions, be they doctors, be they teachers, lawyers, what have you, are really starting to understand that their role is not as the expert, but that they are merely part of a much larger learning process that is controlled by the individual. This is something that librarians can say, duh, we've been doing this for a long time. But if you've been in this profession long enough, or you've researched this profession long enough, you remember in the early days of online databases, you remember in the early days of digital information, when, no, we were the experts. People came to us with their queries, and we were the experts that could search it and sort it and put it into Boolean and send it out there. And now we look at it as saying, no, we're part of a larger process. And that hasn't always been a happy or easy adjustment in our own profession. We've had people talk about, we're not, you know, we're only there to give out the good information. We're only there to give out the selective information. We're only there to look at what we want. But increasingly, we are seeing that our role is not the expert who knows it all, but the person who can help you find it, understand it, contextualize it. Very much like the teacher, very much like the doctor. So this notion of facilitation is something that is a phenomenon not unique to libraries and librarians, but increasingly available in all staffs, in all different positions. So let's take a look at it for a moment. And what I'd like to begin is sort of talk about how then do we define this word of library, and what is it that they do that's unique, that's around facilitation? And to do that, I'm going to sort of tell a story, because I understand that later today you're going to have a session on makerspaces, and I have this great story for makerspaces that I think really brought it home to me about this change and shift in our profession. That's a picture of my son, and he's holding up his Library of the Future. Now, I'll tell you that story really quickly, but then I'll tell you where we ended up with it. The Fayetteville Free Library here in upstate New York was one of the first public libraries in America to have a makerspace with 3D printing and such. And we went and saw it and got a good look through it. And my son decided for his science fair project he was going to design the Library of the Future. Yes, I have truly created a nerd like myself. Anyway, he wanted to do it, and he started drawing it. And then his older brother, I mean, he was about 6 in this picture, and his older brother, who would then be about 9, said, hey, do you want to build it? And they went online and they built it in a software system called Minecraft, which is kind of like Legos, but electronic versions with zombies and such. So they built it in Minecraft. It looked like a really cool library, except it had like bows and arrows and things. But anyway, it was very cool. And then they said, and then I said, well, you know, you built it. Maybe we can turn it into something real. And so we found this piece of software. We downloaded it onto a flash drive. We took it back to the library. And sure enough, we were able to then send it to the 3D printer, and he ended up with that in his hands. Makerspaces are cool. Now, this got us into the makerspaces, so we really liked it. And so we were invited back to a workshop that was going to be on bristlebots. And if you don't know what a bristlebot is, that's a bristlebot. That's a sort of fancy one. But the idea is that you take a toothbrush and you cut off the front with the bristles, and then you attach an old pager vibrating motor, things that used to make it vibrate, still make your phone vibrate, and you attach a battery to it, and then what happens is the bristles start bouncing and they begin moving around your desk or your table, what have you, and you can race them. And this was the idea. So librarians got together, 4 librarians, brought a bunch of preteens, 10-year-olds, 8-year-olds, my 6-year-old was in there, and they said, all right, let's do it. And they started, you know, lopping off these toothbrushes, and they started taping up and gluing and adding the watch batteries, and it turns out they'd bought the wrong watch batteries. So what happened is they bought these really tiny watch batteries which fit really well in the bristlebots and used up all their power in about a quarter of a second. So all these kids would hook up their bristlebots and they'd go and be done. And the librarians freaked out because all the races they had, all the shaping, all the gluing was suddenly undone by the fact that they hadn't bought a powerful enough battery. And what happened is they all sort of, the 3 librarians went into a corner and they began saying, well, what do we do? Who's going to go to the hardware store to buy the better batteries? Do we have the budget? Can we buy? And they're in essence figuring out how to save this session. And as the librarians were in the corner figuring this out, talking about how to make it happen, the kids didn't stop. What the kids started doing is, hey, does anyone have a AA battery? Does anyone have a different kind of battery, a 9-volt or such? And suddenly, they're realizing they're taking out, you know, different devices, and they found some AA batteries, and they're suddenly duct taping full toothbrushes together and attaching them because it turns out it works just well. And they're inventing bristle tanks and bristle spaceships, and they're fighting against each other. And the librarians, in the midst of this, looked up and realized what was happening. What was happening is that the kids were learning without them. that their grand scheme of how they had designed and thought and structured and made this an educational experience that they, in essence, controlled was gone. But something much more interesting and much more authentic was occurring, which is these kids were learning on their own. Now, they couldn't have done it without the librarians having the room, the space, the batteries, the toothbrushes and such, introducing them to the concepts. But the librarians realized that if they got out of the way, these kids learned without them. And so the first thing I wanted to take away from that is this idea of knowledge, because librarians have always talked about being in the knowledge business. We talk about being in the information business. I'll save that for another day. We've always been in the way of trying to figure out how people know more, know better, know how to do things, know new experiences, things about the world. We're in the knowledge business. But the thing is, we have to understand that this idea that knowledge is somehow a thing, that knowledge is something that can be put in a book and put on a shelf, that knowledge is something that can be conveyed from one person to another as if an envelope went from one building to another, that's gone. Knowledge is created. In other words, when those librarians were going to have this thing, teach kids how to glue this together, they couldn't just say, here it is, and transfer it directly into the kids' minds. The kids had to discover it for themselves. And while kids may have been discovering this for years and years and years, to that one child, to my child, that was new knowledge. They created that for themselves. And not only when they created that knowledge, created that understanding of BristleBots, along with it came massive associations with where they learned it in a library, how they learned it by making these tanks, what was fun, what's not. And that context around how to build a BristleBot was unique to my son and unique to the other people in that experience. So even though we all may say 2 plus 2 equals 4, we all know that, I transfer that to you, that's not how it works. I discovered the 2 plus 2 equals 2 for myself. And you discovered it for yourself. And we have different contexts in which that happens. So even though we both agree that 2 plus 2 equals 4, we may be happy about that, we may be sad about that, we may not care about that, we may see that as a power process, we may see that as simply something that happened in school. Maybe a fact that we have to use every day. But we created that unique experience in our own mind. The other thing that those librarians learned and demonstrated very well was that the role of that librarian, as that mission statement says, is to facilitate that creation. Not to make it happen, not to give knowledge out, not to catalog knowledge, not to shelve knowledge, not to put in a building, not to catalog and reference and serve and number and everything, to facilitate the knowledge creation. And this knowledge creation didn't come in a book, it didn't come in a binding, it didn't come in paper, it didn't come in with threads, it didn't come off a shelf. This knowledge came in the form of toothbrushes and batteries and duct tape. And that was librarianship. Just because it happened in a library, that didn't make it librarianship. The fact and the means and the way that they facilitated, that's what made it librarianship. So I want to pick really quickly on two words, that knowledge word and that facilitate word. So let's go back to that knowledge word. I said a little bit about this, but let me talk a little bit about how we have to think about knowledge. If we're going to facilitate it, we better know a little bit about it. First of all, it's uniquely human. It sits up here. Now, some people could argue that dolphins and dogs and all that, fine. I'm not in the dolphin business. I'm not in the dog business. I'm in the people business. So for me, it's a uniquely human experience. If I write a book, the book is not knowledge. What I used to write the book was knowledge. What the reader gains from it is knowledge, and it may not be the same. So the first thing is, it's uniquely human. You can't store it. You can't process it. You can't bundle it. You can only experience and develop it at the individual level. And how do we do that? We do that through conversation. Now, that sounds really sort of casual, like we're all doing it sitting around having conversations and chats over coffee and tea, but that's not what a conversation is exclusively about. That conversation can be between two people, those two kids figuring out what to do with duct tape and what battery fit. But a lot of that conversation can happen between institutions. You're in the EU. There's a lot of conversations about what it means to be European. There's a lot of conversations between the EU and the United States about what it means, frankly, to spy on the EU and whether that's good or bad. But we'll leave that aside. But most of the conversations that we have, and frankly, the most powerful conversations we have, are with ourselves, where we have this dialogue going back and forth about, do I believe it? How do I believe it? Ah, that means if I connect this, oh, I could use it this way. If you just sat there and said, what does he mean by that? And you didn't say it out loud, who were you talking to? That's why we talk about libraries, we talk about them as places of knowledge. Sometimes that means it's quiet spaces, but we're not excluding conversations by having quiet spaces. We're facilitating internal conversations. But increasingly, we're finding the power of doing it out loud and in groups and in social groups and in those groups consisting of not tens of people and hundreds of people, but thousands and millions of people. And so libraries are increasingly becoming loud spaces where conversations are happening among different groups. We'll talk about that in a moment. The other thing I mentioned before is that when we develop this knowledge, when we create our own unique perspective on knowledge, it exists in a networked environment. It exists with context. It exists as it's connected with lots of things. Let's face it, some of our communities have done that with the word library. They've learned that libraries are places of books. That's how they associate the two things. Some of them have learned about library as refuge. Some learn it as library as scholarship. Some look at the library as quiet place. Some look at it as loud place. Some look at it as powerful. Some look at it as obsolete. But the point is that it's unique to how people connect those ideas together, how they connect concepts together, that knowledge is contextualized and that context matters. So if we talk about the idea that libraries are about improving society through facilitating knowledge creation, we have the sense that knowledge is human through conversation, through connections. How do we facilitate that? So let's talk about, when I say facilitate, what is that? What is unique about facilitation? What is it and how does it work? Well, first of all, what do we facilitate? How do we facilitate? We have four basic means as librarians that we facilitate knowledge creation. The first is through access. And we're going to talk about this in a minute. Access is not simply a matter of getting to stuff, getting to books. It's getting to conversations. It's getting to ideas. It's getting to thoughts. It's getting to communities. It's getting to networks. We'll talk about that in a moment. But simply having access to knowledge, having access to a conversation, having access to a computer or a piece of technology is insufficient. That's not enough. For too long, libraries have considered access to be their sole business, but it is only a small portion of what it takes. This comes out of the concept of a digital divide, that there are parts of our communities, parts of our society that didn't have access to the workings of a democracy, the workings of commerce, the workings of society because they didn't have access to technology. So we said, oh, this is easy. We'll give them technology. We'll give them a cell phone. We'll give them a laptop. We'll give them internet connection. We'll give them a phone. Problem solved. The problem in the United States is problem was not solved. Problem was I now had this device and no idea what to do with it, how to do anything with it. It was a great piece of technology that I was completely lost about. So we have to understand that the second means of facilitation is education, is knowledge itself. That is, now that I have access to this device, I know how to use it. Now that I have access to this conversation, I know what language it's in. And I don't just mean languages that it's French or it's English or it's German. But what are the special terms they use? What is the history of that? If I start talking about this, if I'm in physics and I go in and say, hey, what does everyone think about cold fusion? Have I just sort of erased 98% of the credibility I had going into that conversation? So education's not simply a matter of here's how to access things. It's about the conversation, the language, the knowledge, the traditions, the history that's going on. But once again, that's not enough. We know, for example, that plenty of people in authoritarian environments and in high restrictive environments may have access to technology. They may know how to use them, but they may not feel safe in using that. So we must, through our third means of facilitation, provide them an environment in which they feel they can engage in this conversation. So they feel safe once they get to that conversation. You've probably experienced this yourself, particularly if you're sort of new to the profession or new to your job. Right, I talk about the sort of new librarian problem. That is that some library hires the young librarian. It's always young, regardless of how old they are. If they're the new hire, they're the young librarian. They hire the young librarian. They say, we need to be cool, innovative, fancy, on the network. Go do that. Have a good time. Because I'm not going to change. Right? So we hire a person to be our innovation. We hire the person with the least experience, the least credibility, the least connection, the least understanding of our organization, and we say, be innovative. And these librarians go out and they're trying to be innovative, and they're chopped off at the knees by people who go, I don't need that. I don't want to change. Either I don't believe in the change, I don't think you're the one to change, I don't want to do the work. Whatever it is, we create a hostile environment to this new person. Well, we could talk about this as well. We talk about our notions of values around privacy. This idea that you can go and explore a wide range of ideas and we won't track you because we know that if someone's looking over your shoulder, that could prevent a freezing effect. You may not want to go do that. So we provide an environment of physical safety, of intellectual safety to do that. And our fourth means of facilitation, which is even though I have access to the conversation or the technology or the materials, and I know how to access it, what the conversation is, what the language is using, and I feel safe and engaging, I may not want to. So our fourth means of facilitation is motivation. That is, how do people, why do they want to do this? How can we compel them to use this? How can we take something they're compelled to do and make it better? So let's trace these through briefly, and I want to start with access, because like I say, a lot of librarians say, we've got this figured out, Dave. We've been in the access business for 3,000 years. We're good. But I want you to think for a moment about how it changes when you look at knowledge as a conversation, knowledge as uniquely human. Because our traditional form of access is say, look, there's our material, there's our stuff. And there's the person who needs access to it, so we provide materials. Now, if there are lots of people who want to get that material, then we begin getting in the rationing business, right? We begin lending stuff out, and if there's only one person to lend to, no problem. But when there are four and we only have one item, we begin to do things like you can have it for so long, you got to return it, you got to have this restriction, you got to have this authority, etc. And you say, Dave, we figured this out a long time ago. Right? We know that if there are lots of libraries out there, it will just create a consortium, we'll just create a network, and we can share our stuff, completely ignoring the fact that they too have a bunch of people trying to get at that material at the same time. And so what libraries have done is we've gone to this idea that we are lending institutions. We have a collection and we lend them out to people. And that if we just bring in more and more lending institutions, we can extend our reach. But in fact, what we're doing is we're extending a rationing process farther and farther and farther until it breaks. And then we look at things like ebooks and we go crazy because why? Finally, something that we don't technically have to ration, and yet we get licenses and publishers that are forcing us to ration them. How absurd. And yet we've been doing it for a long time. But here's the other problem. The other problem is that we're looking at those little people icons as people who are borrowing our stuff, instead of looking at those people as people with stuff themselves. What if instead of lending things, what if instead of creating a big collection, very expensive, and housing it and then doling it out, we look at ourselves as helping people share things? They have their own materials. Why not allow them to share those materials through our network? Someone walked into the Ann Arbor District Library and they were talking to Eli Nyberger, their associate director, and he said, you know how I can use this catalog to find materials in this library? And Eli said, yes, I do. He says, you know how I can use that to find whether the material is at this building or I can find any of the other branches? And Eli said, yep, I get it. The patron said, is there any reason I can't tell you the stuff I have in my house that I'm willing to share so that they could find it at your library, any of the branches, or at my house? And if they want from my house, I'll bring it in. We'll just lend this stuff out. If you're in a lending model, sort of viewing the library as a collector of stuff and then doling it out, that's crazy talk. That's insane. We'd have to catalog it. We'd have to put it in shrink wrap. We'd have to... But if you look at yourself in the sharing business, that is, you're providing access not simply to your collection, but access to the community's materials, thoughts, ideas, makes perfect sense. And that's just the thing. It's not just the stuff that we can lend. They've got pictures, they've got audios, but they have stories, they have expertise, they have thoughts, they have a heritage, they have their own knowledge that they can share. What we need to begin doing is thinking of the library as a platform, a sharing platform, where, yes, there's always going to be stuff that's very expensive, where we aggregate a bunch of taxes, tuition, money, business currency, whatever, and we buy those really expensive things and share them. Those very rare things and share them. Those things that everyone must have access to and share them. But we're also a platform where people can use it to get to other people's materials, other people's ideas, other people's thoughts, and other people. Imagine that I, as a professor in information science, come up to you as a librarian and I say, I need document X. But then another professor from the anthropology department comes in and says, I need document X. And when you ask both professors, they tend to be working on the same ideas. What imagine if you could connect them, if you could put them together, if you could create a platform for sharing? There was a warehouse worker up in Syracuse who had a great interest in the American Civil War. He was studied it. He understood it. He had artifacts. He had materials. He had developed a great expertise through schooling, through own work around the Civil War of America. But he was a warehouse worker, and he couldn't share it. He was very frustrated. So he would come into the library on a regular basis and ask the librarians, can I get this material? Can I share this material? Can I get it? And they learned of his interest, his knowledge, his expertise in this. And finally, the librarian said, would you mind, we have other people interested in the Civil War as well, would you mind teaching a class on this, giving a session, doing a workshop? And that turned into weekly get-togethers, which were originally lectures with him on a sort of the stage talking to people, that turned into a conversation where people were sharing their knowledge and developing knowledge. And the library created this platform, not where they were giving out Civil War materials, but where they were developing the community's knowledge of the American Civil War by connecting people together. That's what Access is about. And that brings me to my last quick point about Access, which is that for a long time we thought of the library as sort of a conduit where the world's information can be brought to our community. That our job was as a sort of funnel for the world's expertise that we could serve our community. That one-way transmission is a problem. What we need to instead think about is not simply bringing the world's ideas, simply, bringing the world's ideas to our members, our community members, but providing an access, a vehicle to share that information back to the world. If I were traveling to your local town and I went to your public library, could I learn about your local town? Could I learn about local music? Could I learn about the local after-hours scene? Could I learn about what's happening, what you're known most for? Or is that going to look like every other library around you? Why is it that we think of libraries as sort of leading with their back facing the community, saying, look, these are all the good ideas out in the world, ignoring the fact that a lot of those good ideas are sitting right behind us? How can we become a platform for people to share their music, their ideas, their inventions, their concepts, their expertise, their brilliance, their dreams, their aspirations back to the world? How can the library become a platform to publish the conversations of the world? Access. But as I mentioned, that's one of four. Let's talk about that education venue, because we've already sort of started, right? So we started talking about that example with the makerspaces, which is we've done education for a long time. We did bibliographic instruction. We taught people the Dewey Decimal System. We taught people how to find materials and use the library. But that's not the point. The point of instruction is not to help a community be better at using us, it should be better at making the community better. That we need to help the community learn about their problems, their situation, their environments. We'll figure out our situation. We'll make it work. What do you need to do? And increasingly, once again, this isn't sitting as an expert, as a gatekeeper, saying this is what you will know, and sitting as an instructor, but providing instead environments for people to learn, places for them to discover their own world, their own knowledge. Just as my son discovered the idea of bristlebots and bristle tanks on his own, and he truly began to understand the notion of fabrication and makerspaces and design and architecture by having tools that the library provided him, though didn't necessarily teach him how to use, we can see that in lots of different places. This is the community garden out of the North Onondaga Public Library, and it's a place where the community can garden. Now, why am I bringing this up as an educational experience? Because what happened was community members would come into the library and say, I'm really interested in gardening. I want to garden. Now, here's a book on gardening. There's a book on gardening. Here's a material. We'll go find a gardening expert and talk to you. That's one way of doing it. Frankly, that's the easy way of doing it. It's the way we've done it a lot. And I don't want to just pick on libraries. That's the way as a professor we do a lot. I'm a professor. I get up and I talk at you like this, and that's the way we learn. Even though the truth is none of these words will matter until you go try it. What if instead, and what we do, what they did around gardening, which is they said, hey, let's garden. We got a space. We got a spot. We got all this grass next to us. Let's just put it into plots. We'll buy a hose and seeds and let people garden. And you know what happened? People were gardening. This is a family that would garden. You want to learn about gardening? Get your hands dirty. And then they go, why do my tomatoes die and yours do well? Then suddenly their community members going, oh, try this. Oh, try that. Do this. Do that. And by the time the first harvest was in, they had known more about gardening than they ever could from reading a book or finding a material or listening to a lecture, because they had in their hands their product that they created. How can we create learning environments that are about creating learning environments, not learning classes, not lectures, not we went and bought a license to a bunch of online tutorials, we're done. What about creating experiences for people? We talk about designing catalogs and usability and user experience, but what if we talked about learning styles? We build these wonderful interfaces that are great for people who read and write and who learn from reading and writing, not visual images, not auditory images, not experiential images. How do people learn from these systems? How do we build their learning styles and bring them together? We talk about quiet spaces so that people can read, but what about people who can't read? In the United States, we have lots of ethnic communities and underserved ethnic communities. And public libraries have long tried to reach out to them and said, free books, free library cards, come in and read and read and read and read and read and read. Where these underserved communities have built entire knowledge structures, entire learning systems based on talking, on an oral tradition of speaking to their friends and their elders and those that they trust. As someone once said of the Italian libraries, the difference between an American library and an Italian library is when an Italian wants to learn to make sauce, they ask their mother. They don't read it in a book. So does that mean that libraries are exempt from that conversation, are useless in that conversation, that libraries say, oh, well, it's because it's not a book, it's not our problem? Or can we say, well, can you get a hold of your mother? Would you mind if your mother talked to a bunch of other people? Let's set up a kitchen for the day. Now that sounds like, oh, what is that librarianship? But it fits perfectly when you understand what does it take for someone to learn. That's our business, is learning and facilitation by providing access to it, by providing this education, and as we'll see, providing a space for them to do it in, providing them with motivation. In fact, let's move on. So we talked about education. So I have access to the stuff, to the conversation, the material. I now know how to use it. I've read the manual. I've gotten some education. I've gotten some training. But do I feel safe in doing that? That's the environment question. And my greatest example of an awesome experience where libraries have done this is in the idea of human libraries, sometimes called a prejudice library. And that's where libraries have realized for a long time they are safe civic spaces. Even if they're in academic buildings, even if they're in government buildings, even if they're in business buildings, they've always sort of seen themselves as safe spaces where people can come together and have dialogue. And while they may radically disagree, they can do it in a safe civil environment. And so what these human libraries are is that you can go and you can rent out a Muslim, you can rent out a homosexual, you can rent out a white professor from the America, you can rent out someone from this ethnic class or this religious class or this belief structure or this social class, etc. And in a safe place, have a discussion and a dialogue about how commonalities, how do we agree, how can we use these things? How can we create safe environments for people to do this in? The NSA experience with Snowden and sharing all this information is a great example where there's a chance for libraries to educate people about privacy. When you go online, when you're experiencing using these online systems, what are you giving up? Who's watching, and what does it matter towards what you learn? For too long, libraries have viewed privacy as a sacrosanct, monolithic concept that is so worth preserving that we eliminate all records of your use. Yes, you'd like to find out what book you checked out 3 weeks ago, 3 years ago, 30 years ago. Sorry, we delete that information because your privacy is so important. More important than your service. More important than what you want to get. More important than your learning. What we need to look at is the library is a safe place to experiment with privacy, to understand that privacy has value, that understand that privacy is a negotiated thing between a service and an individual, between a society and its citizens, between a government, etc. We should be teaching this in a safe environment, not simply ignoring the conversation or exempting ourselves from that conversation. So, back to our means of facilitation. We have the idea of access. We understand how to use it. We feel safe using it. That doesn't mean we want to use it. There's an old line in America about you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. truth is you can make it drink, but it might drown in the process. The point is, so what? We have lots of people that have access, that have education, that have the trusted environment, but just don't take advantage of that. So we have to talk about motivation. How do we facilitate and motivate people to do things? Now, most libraries for a couple of hundred years have been structured around one form of motivation, and that is intrinsic motivation. And it is the most powerful and important type of motivation. That is, when someone wants to learn or do or understand or comprehend or investigate based on their personal reward structure. I want to know. I want to learn. I want to read. I want to be entertained. I want. You can't beat that intrinsic motivation system. And so libraries are in a very good position in these days of choice because we've always been about choice. But there are other forms of motivation as well. There's the idea of when I go up for tenure as a professor, I put together my citations and this is my impact factor. Well, what if we compelled people to go to a librarian that have expertise in bibliographic information to put that together? It makes the library more important, but it also makes the process more authentic and more trustworthy. That's a form of using extrinsic motivation. We're seeing this in gaming a lot, that if I do this, I get a badge, I get a degree, I get a certificate of completion. Gaming, if I come in, I get a high score. That form of extrinsic motivation, we need to investigate further. But the point is, it is powerful. And we need to not exclude ourselves from one form of motivation, and that is the idea of motivation where it simply comes from internal. That's important, but not the only one. Back to this idea of the Bristlebot, if you will. The Bristlebot showed two forms of motivation. One, that I as a parent said, you got to go learn, you got to go learn. And then the intrinsic motivation, I'm going to play, ooh, this is neat, I'm getting satisfaction, I'm getting peer analysis, what have you. So we talked about knowledge and facilitation, that the way we view knowledge as conversational, as organic, as it contextualized, as uniquely human, sets us apart from many other professions, but not all. Facilitation, our means of facilitation, set us apart from other professions, but not all. Just knowing how librarians view knowledge and facilitation does not uniquely identify them within that mission. There is a third and vital and important part that isn't even mentioned in that mission statement I put before that uniquely identifies librarianship and is what, frankly, makes librarianship a noble profession. And that is our values. The values that we bring to this process, the values that we put in place through facilitation and understanding knowledge and improving society and such, these values, in conjunction with our means and methods and reasons, these values are what create librarians. When we talk about makerspaces and people say, well, why isn't that a community center? Why isn't that a separate environment? What's the difference between a school and this? What's the difference between a public? It's our values. And what are our values? Well, the first and primary one is learning, that we value learning, that we value exposure to new ideas, and that within that, we believe that the richest, most varied, and diverse source of new ideas possible creates the best learning. We don't spoon-feed people just the right answer. Our second value is openness. That is, that when we facilitate, when we do this facilitation process, when we look at you and we talk about services we're building, we do it in the open. If you use our service, we want you to know who can look at the records, when they can look at the records, why they can look at the records. When we set this policy, we want everyone to have input on the policy before we just implement it. We do it out loud. We have a value of intellectual freedom and intellectual safety. And those two things are different, but necessary that they are combined. What I mean is, once again, we believe the best learning happens in the most rich, diverse, and varied information pool that you can choose from. But when you go to look at the dark sides of that information space, when you go to look at the restricted sides, the socially abhorrent sides, you can do so knowing that you will not be watched or judged for doing it. Some of the greatest learning we have is by looking at the most atrocious and terrible things that we have done. Because if we don't look at those, if we don't analyze and understand them, how can we prevent them in the future? That means that we have to look at some pretty dark stuff Dark stuff is an artist. Dark stuff is a scientist. Dark stuff is a politician. Dark stuff is a citizen. Dark stuff as a writer. And you should be able to get to that stuff, free to access it, and feel safe in doing it, knowing that you won't be judged, knowing that you can look at it freely and take from it freely. Those two vital things are essential to facilitation and knowledge. When Facebook talks about facilitating knowledge, there are things they don't want you to access, they don't want you to be able to do. And they're not always clear and open about doing it. So our last value that we bring to this is the notion of intellectual honesty. Now, the value you're probably used to seeing in that place is being unbiased. That as librarians, we provide an unbiased access. That you come in, you can trust us, we're going to give you both sides of the issue. What happens if there are 50 sides of the issue, by the way? What happens if there are two sides of the issue and one side is just stupid? One side's wrong. Do we serve people well by breaking equal statements on sides of issues when there aren't equal positions? As a human being, we have biases. When you wake up in the morning, you are biased to assume that you can get to work by the way you get to work, that the train's going to run or the car's going to go or the path's not going to be blocked. You assume that, and it changes your behavior and action. When someone asks you a question, the first thing you do is start searching, or the first thing you do is reach for a book, you've shown a bias. By being a white male in America, I have many biases, most of them against learning other languages, right? That's the old joke. What do you call someone who speaks three languages? Trilingual. Two languages, bilingual, one language, American, right? I get it. We have biases. We have to acknowledge them. As librarians, we don't say that we don't have them. We acknowledge them and work around them, against them, through them. This is the notion of being intellectually honest, right? To say you're unbiased is not being intellectually honest. You come from a history, a tradition, a viewpoint. By saying things like people need to learn from the most diverse, rich information source, you're showing a bias. By having values, you have a bias. And it's good. But be honest about it. Be open about it. Work with them, through them, around them, but be aware of them. And so we come back to this notion of library and librarian as facilitator. To understand that role, to explore new options, new technologies, what is the role of libraries and librarians with makerspaces? What is the role of libraries and librarians with social networks, with Google Glass, with augmented reality, with the internet, with our purchasing process, with ebooks, with what have you, to understand how we address these new technologies, how we build partnerships because we can't do it alone. In understanding how we enrich our community, we have to first understand what is knowledge, how do we facilitate it, but ultimately reaffirm our values. Librarianship is a noble profession. It is a profession that is noble not simply because of history, not simply because of what we seek to do, but why we do them, because we do them in a principled, valued way. Librarians are radical change agents, radical positive change agents. Radical is a word in English that comes three primary meanings. The first means extreme. The second means fundamental. In other words, to be a radical, to be a leftist, is to be on the extreme side of a political spectrum, but to be radical when you're doing surgery, a radical organ resection, a radical mastectomy, what have you, means you take the whole organ, you get the whole thing. In biology, a radical means that which you can replant and it will regrow the plant, its root system, what have you. And the third meaning is cool, radical. Librarians fit all of those. We are extreme in that we take a principled, fundamental standing and push forward on our community. We believe in innovation and change. We believe in diversity of information. We believe the possibilities of our communities. We have radical trust in them to find what is better for tomorrow. And we do it in cool and fascinating ways. Librarianships as facilitators doesn't mean to be passive and quiet and biased. To be a librarian, to be a facilitator of the community's knowledge, to be the facilitator of a community's goods and dreams and aspirations is not to stand by ready to help. No one has ever changed the world by standing by ready to help. We change the world by reaching out and grasping and pushing and pulling and making things happen, by having change occur. If we expect our communities to have radical positive change, how can we assume that we don't need to change as well? We need to constantly push forward. We need to constantly reinvent our profession. We honor that 3,000-year tradition not by preserving it as if it were some sort of sculpture, but by tearing it down on a regular basis and rebuilding it for a new world and a new environment. Some people feel threatened that libraries of the future are going to be obsolete because of e-books, because of digital information, because of a community shift, because of whatever. No. Libraries are going to be more essential in the future, but not if we stay the same. If not if we believe that the scarcity that our communities face is in information. It doesn't. Our communities are force-fed information. They're drowning information. The scarcity no longer exists in our collections, in our buildings, in our materials, in our stuff. Scarcity's here. The scarcity's of attention. The scarcity is of a businessman trying to make a billion-dollar decision and not knowing how to read all the financial information or what databases to get to or spending time in finding that information, having scarce resources. The scarcity is in the mother trying to raise a child, trying to understand what the best nutritional information they can provide to their child is when there are so many sources. That's the scarcity that we seek to continually solve, because libraries for those 3,000 years, while we have used different tools and different mechanisms, have always sought to facilitate knowledge creation. It is why we are noble and why we are enduring and why we will continue to endure and why we will continue to change and innovate. Today is but another step, an important step, towards that future, towards that essential nature, towards that nobility, towards helping our communities understand what they can be and achieving those aspirations. And tomorrow will be another day, and the day after that. And if you approach them as opportunities to expand, invest, and innovate and change, you will do well. If instead you look at it as simply a new set of tools and things to stick on a shelf, virtual or real, then you're giving up the discussion. I welcome the discussion. I welcome your comments, and I thank you for your time.